Inge, I don't even heard of him, is reputed to have said once that a religion without a history is a nervous disorder. Dean Inge seems to have been the kind of man who came out with witty things like that all the time. A religion without a history is a nervous disorder. Indeed, you may have seen back in October and November, if you read the Church Times, which I hope some of you do, they had a rather spirited debate in the letters pages back in, I think, October, November time, about Anglican history, its uses and abuses, and whether we've all rather forgotten about the origins and development of the Church of England. Tom Wright's work on the New Testament makes a lot of this idea of story and how reconstructing what he calls the narrative thought world of people in the first century can help us understand the New Testament better. Well, whether his new perspective is a better way of reading the New Testament, we'll have to leave as a question for another time. But I think Wright is onto something more generally there, isn't he? Because we're certainly affected by the stories that we tell each other and the stories that we believe about ourselves and about other people. As Reformed evangelicals in the Church of England, we have a fantastic heritage, which perhaps we don't know and talk about as much as we should. In the debates over the history of our denomination and of Christianity in our country, it matters immensely, psychologically, where we see ourselves in that story. And it matters because it affects our vision of where we think the story is going in the future and what we do about it in the here and now. Of course, history never precisely replicates itself, but there are patterns, aren't there, in history which do repeat themselves simply because humanity, in all its sinfulness, has remained the same. Now, Church Society, of course, is all about Bible, Church and nation. And it's important for us to realise that as we seek to teach the Reformed biblical faith, reform the churches that we're part of and the denomination, and we seek to proclaim the gospel to our nation, we're not fighting for something that we have no right to. It can sometimes seem that way, can't it, when the majority is very much against us. The gospel we preach can sometimes be most unwelcome, especially so in the councils and synods of the church. So is it just me, but are we tempted to wonder sometimes, what right do we have to be here? But no, we are striving to recover what was always ours. And an understanding of our history can help us revitalise that confidence. And that's hugely important for the future. Because for one reason, it makes a huge difference to how young people see the Church of England. We've noticed in recent years at St Helens, for example, that although good men and women do still desire the noble task of leadership and service in the church in full-time ministry, it's harder and harder recently to persuade them that Anglican ministry is a viable and fruitful option. See, Anglicanism, they say, it's so torn apart by divisions over liberal theology and liberalising practices that, you know, these keen, servant-hearted young people just, they don't want a part of that. They're deeply upset by it and they can't see what's the point of getting involved. Now, some of that may just be immaturity, of course. Is the grass always greener in other denominations and churches? Are we afraid to face opposition and persecution for the gospel? Or are we just after an easy pastoral life with a nice comfortable pension in our retirement? Well, there may be some of that. There may be some of it. But some of this loss of interest in the Church of England is due to our lack of historical awareness. So retelling this story is a vital part of restoring not the glamour, but certainly the glory of being a part of the Church of England and of being a Reformed evangelical Anglican. Now, one of the great Reformed evangelical Anglicans of the past was the 18th century writer Augustus Montagu Toplady. I've been enjoying getting to know him and his work over the last few years. And one of the things he does especially well is retelling the story of theology and of the gospel in this country particularly, but in the Anglican Church as well. So before we look at Top Lady just a little bit and his times later on this afternoon, we're going to look first in this session at something of that story leading up to Top Lady's day. So this morning we're going to go from the Reformation up to the end of the 17th century, looking particularly, as James said, at the great ejection and the great persecution of the Puritans. And then this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we'll look more at the Great Awakening, the evangelical revival, which took place in the 18th century. Now, this is not going to be a dispassionate, unbiased analysis of events. I have an agenda. I want us to see ourselves in this story. And if I can, I want us to make us feel that we are part of it and that it is part of us and who we are. So there may be parallels here for us to draw from the past for our own situation. Things that we can learn from the mistakes of our forebears and from their triumphs. Now, church history is not just something that happened to other people a long time ago. This is, as you can put it like this is family history for us. And we are meant to be passionate about it. Now, sadly, I wasn't here yesterday to hear Roger Beckwith's talk on the opening talk of the conference. But having spoken to Roger beforehand and told him what I wanted to do in these sessions, he's thought that there wasn't going to be too much overlap. And I hope that's true. So I should just go for it anyway, he said. So we're going to dive in with the Reformation. And let's look at how we ended up with a reformed establishment. That's point one on the handout if you're following along there. So the English Reformation of the 16th century broke the stranglehold of Rome and began a very long process of social and religious change. This inevitably brought quite a lot of tensions into the church between the forces of conservatism seeking to retain the structures and the medieval theologies of the past and the forces of transformation, which sought to radically change things in biblical directions. And this tension played itself out at the highest level as the government lurched from one side to the other during the reigns of the great Protestant Edward VI, at which point you're supposed to cheer. Let's try that again. The great Protestant king, Edward VI. And let's see what you do with this. And the great Roman Catholic, Bloody Mary. Thank you. So we're supposed to be passionate about this. That's right. We're involved. So following that lurch from side to side, the religious scene of 1558 to 1603 is often portrayed by historians as the Elizabethan settlement, a stable via media, middle way between Rome and Geneva. But there are two things wrong, at least two things wrong, with that idyllic picture of the Elizabethan golden age. First, it wasn't particularly a stable and settled time. There remained very significant tensions, albeit underneath the surface, which meant that it was never an entirely comfortable settlement. So the Puritan nonconformists of the period were constantly agitating for further godly reformation. And as you know, the Catholics on the other side were always on the lookout for ways back into power. So it was often a very turbulent time. But second, it was also a period of immense success and prosperity for Reformed theology. As Jonathan Moore reiterated in this excellent book on the Puritan divine John Preston recently, he says here, England and Scotland were the only kingdoms in the 16th century in which the Reformed faith was established as the national religion. The national religion. So the 39 Articles, the prayer book and the homilies. Are you cheering inwardly as I say that? The 39 Articles, the prayer book and the homilies all witness to the success of Reformed theology in England. It was not, as some have tried to make it seem, as if the Calvinistic Puritans were an extreme bunch, you know, out here, out of touch with a nice, moderate, established religion. No, there was widespread consensus, reformed consensus in the church. And as Moore says, there was a firm conviction that salvation is by predestinating grace and not the grace of sacramentalism. And that therefore the Church of Rome, in his words, is to be abhorred, and every resurgence of its ceremonialism is to be fiercely resisted. At this period, English divines, theologians like William Perkins of Cambridge, had an international reputation. And even the Archbishops of Canterbury at this time were all solidly reformed in their outlook, even if they weren't always as keen as some of the Puritans were on nonconformist ways of propagating the faith. Imagine that, a reformed Archbishop of Canterbury. The works of Calvin and of other Swiss reformers like Bullinger were held in very high regard in the English church. So in 1586, for example, Archbishop of Canterbury Whitgift ordered that every minister should buy a copy of the Bible. Should have had one of those already, really, but should buy a copy of the Bible, a notebook, and a copy of Bullinger's masterpiece, a reformed work of theology called The Decades. They were to read a chapter of the Bible every day and make notes on it. And then every week, they also had to read a chapter of Bullinger as well and make notes on that. The notes were to be shown to somebody every quarter. And if they weren't acceptable, the clergyman was to be censored. I wonder how that would go down today. What do you think in your diocese if that was suggested? Fox's solidly reformed Book of Martyrs and Bishop Jewell's masterful defence of the Church of England were ordered to be placed in every parish church. Now, I'll just go through some of those things to show that these are not signs of a church that thinks of itself as halfway between Rome moving away from Geneva. No, the established church was reformed. Salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, was our national creed. Now, Jonathan Moore's book, which I just quoted just now, is a terrific study of the softening of Reformed theology at the end of this period, at the end of the 16th and into the 17th century. The man he's studying here, John Preston, and other English divines, and also the Irish Archbishop, James Usher, began to subtly alter the structure of Reformed theology from within. They came up with something that we now call hypothetical universalism. That is, a Calvinistic alternative to the accepted doctrine of limited atonement, or as it was called back then, particular redemption. Now, I'll come back to that a little bit later. But that sort of tinkering at the edges of Reformed theology did muddy the waters somewhat and compromise the doctrines of grace at the end of this period, although it was still firmly within the Reformed framework. But it did ultimately pave the way for the rise of something ultimately much more dangerous, something called Arminianism. And so we move on to point two there, the Arminian challenge from 1603 onwards. A Dutch theologian, Jacob Harmenszoon, anyone who speaks Dutch, they can correct my pronunciation later. Jacob Harmenszoon was born in 1560, ordained in 1588 after studying under Beza, Calvin's successor, in Geneva. A professor at Leiden, he Latinized his name as Arminius. Now, interestingly, I only discovered this recently, but that may have been a way of linking himself with a more famous man at this time, a German tribal chieftain called Arminius, who opposed the Roman Empire in the closing decades of the first century BC. Now, that Arminius, the ancient one, was used during the Reformation as a symbol of the German people and their fight against Rome. However, many saw in this new Dutch Arminius and his theology a slippery slope that would lead Reformed Christians straight back into the arms of the Pope. And that's because on issues like free will, predestination, the atonement, and perseverance, Arminianism stood opposed to Calvinism and was much, much closer to the Roman Catholic view. And Toplady isn't the only person in this period to link Arminian doctrine with the old heresy of Pelagianism, the idea that good works should be given a greater place in the scheme of salvation than they really ought to be. Now, some of these ideas were being debated in Cambridge at the end of the 16th century. And in response to that challenge to the orthodoxy of the day, in 1595, Archbishop Whitgift produced what are known as the Lambeth Articles, 9 brief statements of Reformed thought on predestination and perseverance, which were obviously intended to clarify the meaning of the 39 Articles in an obviously Calvinist direction. Arminian doctrine, however, was spreading rapidly in the Netherlands, and this led eventually to something called the Synod of Dort, an international gathering of Reformed theologians from all over Europe to discuss the disputed points. Now, Britain, as I said, was thought of as a Reformed state, and so we were invited to send a church delegation to the Synod of Dort. Now, as you probably know, the Synod countered the Arminians' 5 points of protest with 5 points of their own, now best remembered by the mnemonic TULIP, which is a peculiarly appropriate mnemonic for something that originates in Holland. So let's go through TULIP recently. I'm sorry if this is teaching grandmother to suck eggs, as it were, but instead of the soft Arminian view of sin, the Synod affirmed that every part of us is depraved and fallen. Total depravity, T. That we are not chosen by God because he foresees something in us, but we are unconditionally elect. That Christ died for that particular group of people, those that the Father gave to him, rather than indiscriminately for everyone. So his atonement is limited, the L in TULIP, in that way. It's limited, though, of course, we know everybody limits the atonement in some way, don't they? Calvinists at Dort limit who it's applied to. It's applied only to the elect. Arminians limit the effectiveness of the atonement. So for them, the cross doesn't actually save anybody. It just makes them savable if they add their own faith and good works to it. Then the I in TULIP is for irresistible grace, the idea that if God wants you, he'll have you. Whereas Arminians taught that God can want you in heaven, but you can resist him and you can win. And the P is for perseverance, or better, maybe the preservation of the saints. No one can snatch the elect from God's hands, said the Synod of Dort. Whereas the Arminians were teaching that even regenerate Christians could finally fall away. So there we are. That's an outline of what they were saying. Now, interestingly, some of the British delegates to the Synod of Dort were what I just mentioned as a hypothetical universalists when it came to the atonement issue. That is, they weren't Arminians, so they're not beyond the pale in that sense, but they did have a slightly different view on limited atonement. Now, I think their final acceptance of the canons of Dort, the statement that was put out by the Synod of Dort, they accepted that and they signed it. I think that shows that the canons of Dort were deliberately framed in such a way as to not exclude this subtle declension from Reformed orthodoxy. So actually, you may have heard them sometimes described as 4.5-point Calvinists or 4-point Calvinists. That's not accurate, really, to describe a hypothetical universalist in that way. Excuse me. You're taking out all the coughs from the recording, so that's good. Bishop Davenant, as he later became, and other Reformed Brits who attended the Synod of Dort actually signed up for all 5 points. All 5 points. It's just the atonement point at the Synod of Dort was not quite as tightly defined as some Calvinists would have liked it to be. But The Synod of Dort was devastatingly, devastatingly clear in refuting the clearly liberal Arminianism. But this was not enough to prevent the spread of new ideas. Queen Elizabeth's successor, James I, was a Calvinist. But it was during his reign, ironically, and that of his son, Charles I, that things began to go downhill. Charles married a Catholic princess and allied himself with notorious Arminians, thus providing grist for the mill for those who saw a tight link between these two forms of theology, between Arminianism, the liberal Arminianism, and Catholicism. Things, of course, started going particularly badly in 1633, when the committed Arminian William Laud was appointed as the Archbishop of Canterbury. I think we should do that again, and we need a boo at that point. The committed Arminian William Laud was appointed as the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, I say we should boo because he was a rather obnoxious and ambitious man. He had no qualms about using the Court of Star Chamber, a 17th century equivalent of Guantanamo Bay, if you like, to convict and torture his opponents. Crossing Archbishop Laud could result in you having your ears cropped or your cheeks branded. So that's not something that was done lightly. Laud was vigorous in attempting to drive out the Calvinists and to overturn the reformed consensus that I've described that had prevailed since Edward and Elizabeth. And in this, he largely succeeded for a while. But he also succeeded in uniting everybody who disliked him and who disliked his theology and his king and his politics. So it's no surprise that we had a civil war. And in the ensuing civil wars, which had religious issues right at their heart, Laud had his head chopped off on Tower Hill in January 1645. Yes, you're allowed to cheer at that point. But as you'll know, Charles I's head also joined Laud's head in 1649, thus beginning the period of the Commonwealth, or the Interregnum. It's good that not every interregnum begins with a beheading. Though some PCCs may prefer it that way. During this time, during the interregnum, the Commonwealth period, the Reformed theology was again enshrined at the heart of our national church life. So yes, there was considerable freedom of religion under Oliver Cromwell. So all kinds of nutcases had liberty to indulge in their weird and wacky ideas and beliefs and publish their rantings and ravings without censorship. But with men like John Owen training pastors at Oxford and the Westminster Assembly writing its confession and its catechisms and screening appointments to all churches, it was clear in which direction things were facing. So Arminianism, allied to Catholicism and the arbitrary abuse of royal power, was overturned. And Reformed theology was once again back on top, albeit now with something of a Puritan and Presbyterian flavour, rather than an Anglican one. And there was still a place at the heart of things for some Calvinist dissenters, such as the hypothetical Universalists I just mentioned. So if you look at the minutes of the Westminster Assembly, for instance, they reveal a vibrant and significant minority of the divines held to a subtle universal understanding of the extent of the atonement. So I think they could subscribe to the Confession of Faith, just about. They certainly occupied some very important positions. So the story so far, then, is of Protestantism taking over from Catholicism. And then later, as Protestantism fragments a little bit in Europe, in England we find that it was the Reformed branch of Protestantism which gained the upper hand, rather than the more Lutheran strand. I'm going to pause at this point and see if anyone has any questions on everything I've said so far. We've plenty of time. Stephen, yeah.
You mentioned British delegates to Dort. Were there not separate representations from Scotland and England, or was it just one delegation?
I think it was technically, was there a British delegation at the Synod of Dort or just an English one and a Scottish one? That's the question, yeah. I think it was, it's known as the British delegation to the Synod of Dort because James I, of course, united the crown in himself of Scotland and England. So there were Scottish delegates as part of that British delegation sent by James. But I think because they were sent by James, the king, they were known as a united delegation. So, yeah, there were several Scottish members there as well as English. So, is that fair? Hmm? Okay. Go on, Frank.
Could you repeat the name of Bullinger's book, which you mentioned?
The Decades. Bullinger's book that I mentioned is called The Decades.
The Decades.
It's a lot of sermons.
And also, let me see.
Arranged in tens.
The Reformed rather than the Lutheran
yes.
Reformation. Could you just briefly say the difference between them, just in a sentence or so?
You want me to, I'm just repeating it for the tape, but you want me to sort of outline the difference between the Lutheran strand and the Reformed strands of the Reformation? Yeah. Of course, at the beginning of the Reformation, in the early part of the 16th century into the middle of the 16th century, the Reformation was pretty much an undifferentiated thing, so you wouldn't have a different strand, Lutheran or Reformed. But as things progressed into the 1540s and 50s particularly, Reformed views, people like Zwingli and Calvin, became different to Lutheran views, so Luther and Melanchthon and others there. It wasn't just a Germany versus Switzerland thing, but there were different strands, particularly, of course, over the sacrament, over of the Lord's Supper. So there were big debates over that. Luther said that Zwingli and others weren't brothers because of their disagreements over the sacrament. Yeah, it was over that particular issue. But of course, as they split over that issue, it does have large ramifications for the rest of your theology. So I think from the 1550s onwards, there's a divergence in theology between a Reformed strand and a Lutheran strand. I'm going to say a bit more about that in my book on Toplady in this whole period, because I think since the early 19th century, there's been a strand of thought in this country that we are Lutheran, not Reformed. So there was a book in 1804, the Bampton Lectures, I think it was, that said that was against the Calvinistical understanding of the 39 Articles. So, Article 17 is not Calvinist, it's Lutheran, which to him, to them meant something different. But I think that is actually a resurgence of an Arminian understanding, because later Lutherans disagreed with Luther on free will and predestination. So they became more Arminian, if you can put it like that, in their theology.
The English working classes, like me, they'd have been influenced perhaps more by the Lollards than by Luther. Presumably, because a lot of them, I should imagine, about half of them would be able to read English, so they'd be able to read the books of Wycliffe and his followers, but probably not the Latin of Luther. So would that have something to do with it, the fact that Lollardry was, or Lollardism, was more popular amongst the masses in England?
Was Lollardism more important than Luther because people could read English Lollards, but they couldn't read German or Latin? A lot of Luther's stuff was translated into English. Some of it was not so good. And the Westminster Assembly at one point has a minute saying, we've read the translation of this work, we think it's a bit Luther, so we're not going to allow it. Because he was a bit funny sometimes. I think the Lollard influence was still great on the ground, definitely.
Yeah. It wouldn't be the same as the Lutheran influence.
I think the biggest... there is this kind of divergence over the Reformation. Is it a Reformation from below or above?
Yeah, exactly.
And below, obviously, the Lollards are on the ground. But I think from above, the Reformed impulse is much stronger with Cranmer. So Cranmer rejects, eventually, the consubstantiation, the Lutheran idea of the Lord's Supper, and becomes a Reformed Catholic, as Dermot McCulloch calls him in his biography. So it's Cranmer who introduces the Reformed, distinctively Reformed strand of Protestantism into this country, with the Articles and the liturgies and stuff. So from above and from below, things were working against the Lutheran strand. Yeah. But I say part of the people wanting to reread things as all Lutheran and not Reformed is because they want to get rid of some of the Calvinistical understandings of our Articles. It's an Arminian impulse, because later Lutheranism became much more Arminian in its theology. Sorry, any other questions? One at the back. Yes, hello.
You have any comment about the Reformed Church in France? I think they also went for a four-point Calvinism, which in actual fact
So the Reformed Church in France, and did they go off into four-point Calvinism as well? Of course, the main figure in hypothetical universalism circles is a Frenchman, Moses Amirault, from whom we get Amiraldianism. And he is a French theologian, a Calvinist theologian, but who had distinctively different views on the atonement. And not all hypothetical universalists, those who are Calvinists but disagree with the Arminians, and with the consensus. Not all hypothetical universalists are Amiraldian. Amirault had a particular way of being a Calvinist non-Arminian. He reordered the decrees rather than just talking about the atonement, and that gave it a particular slant. I wouldn't say much about that, although Amirault was read in the Westminster Assembly. People were passing his book around. At one point, one of the Scottish delegates complains about how Amirault's book is being circulated and passed between people in brown paper envelopes in the Westminster Assembly. But they were countering that as well.
An introduction to hermeneutics to the ordinary people.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you would like to say something about that.
Would I like to say something about Tyndale? Yes, Tyndale's a brilliant guy. Of course, his translation of the Bible is, you know, unsurpassed almost. I mean, in that time, it was just a superb piece of work. The Pathway into Holy Scripture, a great understanding. It's like How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth in its day. So he was doing the job of, you know, the ESV and Graham Goldsworthy and all sorts of other people all rolled into one. Tyndale's a remarkable figure. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't say more about him, but... Oh, well, we look forward to that. I look forward to what you have to say about Tyndale. Is that coming out in Crossway or something like that? Or?
No, it's an M-Phil, actually.
An M-Phil? Well, even better. Marvellous. Well, we look forward to that.
The Commonwealth, some people say the Commonwealth was miserable, dull, oppressive, depressing. Would you say that that's only true of the binge drinkers at the time?
Would I say that the only people who complained about the Commonwealth period were the binge drinkers of the time?
Well,
yes.
Because if you talk about the Commonwealth period... A secular historian will say, oh, it was depressing, it was dull, miserable.
They banned Christmas.
Oh, terrible, yes.
Yes, and mince pies and things like that. Yeah. Yes, well, there's a big debate about that. I think Puritanism has been underrated and, misperceptions of what Puritanism is. And it wasn't all straight-laced and let's not have any fun and that sort of thing. So...
Would you say they tried to have a disciplined society?
Disciplined society, disciplined Christian life? No, they didn't.
And,
of course, the immorality thing was a function of the Calvinist-Arminian thing. So, as was asked, go on to that in a moment, about immorality came back like a flood when Arminianism returned in the shape of Charles II. But we're getting on to that now. So, unless there's any other major questions at that point, let's plough on. We're on part three, an Arminian victory. So as I said before, Reformed theology so far has had the upper hand in British society, but it was not to last. And Arminian victory in this ongoing battle was just around the corner. And so to this we now turn. We're going to look at the events surrounding the tragedy of 1662 after Charles II was restored to the throne. And of course, if you want more detail on this formative period in our history, you can look at this excellent book, which James was telling us about earlier, The Tragedy of 1662, available in all good bookshops. Sadly, Oliver Cromwell blew it for a whole number of reasons, which we don't have time to go into in depth now. But without a king, England failed to achieve any kind of political stability. And resting everything on the military was never going to win hearts and minds, and never, nor was banning Christmas. Parliament called for the return of Charles I's son as king, and on his way back, Charles II promised his subjects that on his return there would be a liberty for tender consciences, and no man shall be called into question for differences of opinion in matters of religion, as long as they don't disturb the peace of the kingdom. Of course, that was greeted with delighted optimism. In the early months, it seemed as if the so-called Presbyterians, the Reformed Puritans committed to the Bible and the National Church, would have their way. Richard Baxter and other leading Puritan divines were appointed as chaplains to the king and granted an audience with him. But all was not as it appeared behind the scenes. Perhaps the king himself was sincere enough in his statements, but he was surrounded by men who were thirsting for revenge. And once he was safely back on the throne, Charles found he had to make concessions to those Laudian extremists, and all his good intentions for tolerance were severely compromised. Arminianism flooded back in, allied to another king with a taste for arbitrary rule and another Catholic princess as a wife. His advisers and bishops quickly proceeded, but cautiously, to recapture the establishment by stealth. So while the king might speak graciously to his Presbyterian and Reformed subjects, his favour was showered upon the Laudians, the Arminians. So Reformed Puritans of various persuasions were jostling for position with these returning Anglicans and Arminians. Gilbert Sheldon was one of them, the Bishop of London, spearheading the attack and used the Crown's patronage rights to appoint members of his own circle and party to strategic posts in both the church and the universities. Sheldon, the Bishop of London, hated the Reformed faith. It's not too strong a word to use. He hated it and was not afraid to use strong-arm tactics to impose his will on the Diocese of London. He regarded changing the governing constitutions of churches as one of his most useful tools. Now, we have evidence of such an attack on entrenched nonconformity from one of the most notoriously radical of the city parishes, St. Stephen's Coleman Street, just outside the Bank of England. It was known even before the Civil War for its staunchly Puritan flavour. This staunchly Puritan Reformed church was run by a former St. Peter's Cornhill lecturer called William Taylor. I'm not making this up. William Taylor, of course, is the name of my boss at St. Helens Bishopsgate. The living of this influential London church was declared officially vacant because William Taylor refused to sign up to the new 1660 Oath of Allegiance. But a meeting of the whole of the parish of St. Stephen's, which had the right of appointment, immediately re-elected Taylor as their minister. And this sparked a bit of a battle for control. The bishop pressurised Taylor, but when he died in 1661, September, probably from exhaustion, from all of this fighting, the parish appointed one man to replace him, and the bishop appointed another. The parishioners, though, had one very important weapon against the bishop. A large part of the minister's stipend had customarily been made up by the parish because the ancient endowment was inadequate. So, of course, they used their leverage against the diocese and they withheld their quota, as it were. This set in motion... You're allowed to cheer. Well done. This set in motion some protracted legal wrangling while the bishop attempted to change the constitution of the church so he could foist his own list of candidates onto a smaller, more compliant church council. Interestingly, the bishop was also trying similarly aggressive tactics against other churches in the city at the same time. Indeed, records show that Bishop Sheldon, what he tried against William Taylor's church, he also tried against a place called St. Helens Bishopsgate. Now, a group of Puritans at this point who were strongly in favour of some kind of national church structure and wanted to compromise with the Anglicans in some way met up with some of the bishops to try and thrash these issues through. Other evangelical groups, such as the Independent Congregationalists and the Anabaptists, were infuriated with these so-called Presbyterian leaders, though not all of them were Presbyterians in the strict sense of that word. They thought that it would be better for all of them to work together to influence the settlement. And in jockeying for position and influence in the coming new order, evangelical groups inevitably disagreed on tactics and the limits of toleration. They were thus divided and soon to be conquered. government pressure and the inevitable backlash against those who'd held power for so long under the Commonwealth led to the election of the so-called Cavalier Parliament. And it was this Parliament, along with the bishops who'd now been restored to the House of Lords, which would begin to persecute the Puritans. In this atmosphere, a group of Presbyterian and Anglican divines met at the Bishop of London's residence at the Savoy to discuss changes in the liturgy. But this so-called Savoy Conference was not a conferring of equals in a common task. No, the bishops claimed that they had no desire whatsoever to change the liturgy, and led by the very politically savvy Sheldon, they manoeuvred the Presbyterians into the position of humble supplicants, begging for exceptions and changes. An extensive list of exceptions to the 1604 Book of Common Prayer was presented, but there was an air of dismissive superiority in the whole tone of the bishops' answers. Plus, the Presbyterians made the mistake of allowing Richard Baxter to be their spokesman. The bishops didn't like him. Baxter got their backs up, and he was sadly lacking in political skill and, let's say, charm. Great writer, preacher, no political charm. So when a new Book of Common Prayer was finally unveiled, over 600 changes had been made to Cranmer's liturgy, with only a few of those tipping the hat to the Puritan exceptions, and many of them were leaning decidedly in the opposite direction. The liturgy, in fact, of 1662 contained so many objectionable elements that the Puritans could never assent to it without serious reservation. The only question then remained, how assiduously are they going to enforce this? What level of assent are they going to demand to its contents? And so we come to the great ejection. The Act of Uniformity, which was passed by Parliament in May 1662, was draconian and rigorous. The form of subscription required of ministers, who must now be episcopally ordained and or reordained after the confusion of the Commonwealth period, it was demanded of them unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything contained and prescribed in the BCP. Furthermore, it required all ministers and lecturers and even school teachers to denounce taking up arms against the king, and they also had to renounce their right to endeavour any change or alteration of government in church or state. All that was to be enacted on St. Bartholomew's Day, 24th of August. The significance of that day was not just that it recalled the French massacre of thousands of Protestant Huguenots on the same day in 1572, but it was also the day that tithes and rents were due to be paid to the ministers. So if the ministers did not conform, they would lose all their money for a year, or at least for a quarter, thus impoverishing most of them at a stroke. Nice political move, don't you think? Now, the Act of Uniformity of 1662 did not pass without a fight, and many of its provisions passed in Parliament with only very slender majorities. But defeat by a slender majority remained defeat. At least 936 ministers were thus deprived of their livings in 1662, with a further 129 deprived sometime between 1660 and 1663, and with the ejections of 1660 as well, because in 1660 all the royalist clergy had been allowed to come back and take over their livings again, and of course they booted out those who didn't believe in infant baptism. Sorry about that. They were also ejected from their parishes in 1660, and that meant that a total of 1,760 ministers were thrust out of the Church of England. Now that's 20% of the ministers in the church, silenced from preaching and teaching by law and deprived of their livelihood. Almost all of them were Reformed Evangelical Puritans. And so 1662 may be said to represent the expulsion of Reformed Puritanism from the National Church. a momentous and sad day indeed. Now, why did they all go? Why did they go? Well, they felt for a start that they couldn't renounce and denounce all those oaths that they had solemnly taken during the Commonwealth period. Oaths to reform religion according to the word of God and to fight against tyrannical government. We can't just say that was nonsense and that we don't agree with ourselves anymore when we made those oaths, they said. But they also left because they couldn't give unfeigned consent and assent to all and everything in the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. Such strong assent had never been demanded before now, and they just could not give it. See, that would be like saying that the BCP was infallible, something they rejected in the Pope and didn't want to assert for a liturgy which had so many objectionable things in it. What objectionable things, I hear you cry? Well, they didn't all object to liturgy per se, as many do today, although John Owen did write a very interesting tract against liturgies. No, the Puritans mostly scrupled at just things within the liturgy, things like, firstly, the use of the Apocrypha in the lectionary, as if it was scripture. So Bell and the Dragon, which is a great story, but is not scripture, was reinserted into the calendar of readings in 1662. Other objections centred on the baptism liturgy, that it strictly requires godparents, which scripture does not, and hardly even mentions fathers, which scripture explicitly does. Obviously, they also disliked things like the signing of the cross in baptism, because it gives the impression, they said, that baptizing with water is not sufficient in and of itself. It's a sacrament within a sacrament, they said, to insist on that. Thirdly, the order for the burial of the dead was objectionable to the Puritans because it extended a charitable presumption to everybody buried under this rite. Even notorious sinners had to be pronounced safe at death using the service in the BCP, which the Puritans just could not accept. And no doubt there were other issues for individual Puritans. Some, of course, of the reformed clergy were happy to conform, or they were able to do so with a kind of nod and a wink from a sympathetic bishop. So that did happen. People were able to conform with a bit of nod and a wink or by signing some objection in a book. But that relied on a sympathetic bishop in your diocese. Interestingly, the new Book of Common Prayer didn't actually come off the presses itself. You know, it wasn't actually printed up until just before the 24th of August. So out of the 7,000 ministers who kept their livings, only a few who lived in or near to London and where the printing presses were could have had sight of the actual book that they were saying was, you know, infallible in all and everything. Well, it was for these sorts of reasons that the minister of St. Helens, Bishopsgate, was deprived of his living in 1662. Let me tell you a bit about him. The Reverend Arthur Barham, I imagine you've never even heard of him. The Reverend Arthur Barham once considered a career in the law, but when his father died, he sold all his law books and went to Cambridge, where he studied divinity with great diligence and delight. It's a good thing to do, to go to Cambridge to study divinity with great diligence and delight. He was the minister at St. Helens for about 15 years, preaching, we're told, with great success. He was a convinced reformed minister, but now his energy would have to be directed outside of the established church. As you will know, the Act of Uniformity of 1662 also denied the academy and the church of the talents of men like John Owen, Richard Baxter, John Bunyan, Thomas Watson, Stephen Charnock. But as Ian Murray writes, we would greatly underestimate the seriousness of 1662 if we imagine that the cleavage which then took place was only over a few phrases in the Book of Common Prayer and forms of church order. Those things were involved, but the Puritans regarded them as only part of a much wider issue, namely, what is the nature of true Christianity? The nonconformists believed that in acting as they did, they were acting for the gospel. It was a gospel issue, the gospel of the sovereign grace of God. The theme of loss comes into the farewell sermons of the ejected. Not just the relational loss that a pastor feels when he's torn away from his people, but the loss of the gospel, which results when pulpits fall silent. So I was talking to James before about, he's just been reading the sermons of the Great Ejection that Banner of Truth published in 1962, I think. It's out of print, but if you can get hold of it, there's some cracking sermons in there. Here's a quote from the illegal sermon, which got Edmund Calamy thrown into prison. He asks this: wherein does England excel other places? There's more wealth in Turkey than in England, he said, and the heathen nations have more of the glory of the world than any Christian king has. What is the glory of England? Is it not Christianity? What is the glory of Christianity, if not the gospel? If the gospel be gone, our glory is gone in England. Calamy had been an influential member of the Westminster Assembly and was perhaps the most significant of the hypothetical universalists amongst the reformed preachers of the time. Another powerful preacher was Thomas Brooks. In his farewell sermon, the week before St. Bartholomew's Day, he asked his congregation, is God removing the gospel from England by this dreadful ejection? That is the fear of many, but I humbly suppose he will not do it, he said. And of the 9 reasons that he then gives for his confidence, of course, the Puritans, they have to have at least 9 reasons for everything. His third reason is this. This is why he doesn't think God is removing the gospel. He says, the ineffectiveness of all former attempts and designs to destroy the gospel persuades me otherwise. You know what endeavours of old there have been to darken the sun, to put out the light of heaven. In the days of Mary, in the days since then, and yet the gospel has defied prisons, racks, flames, pillories, or anything else to extinguish the glory of it. To this, in his last sermon at St. Stephen's Walbrook, Thomas Watson adds, what are all the sufferings we can undergo in the world in comparison with eternity? And so it was with truly evangelical sentiments such as these that the Church of England was deprived of its leading reformed thinkers and preachers and pastors. The king loved it, though. The day before Black Bartholomew's Day, he threw a great party in London with 10,000 barges and boats piling up on the River Thames, his mistress on public display with their illegitimate child. A great way to distract the hoi polloi, as the Arminian bishops rubbed their hands together in glee. And so we come to the great persecution. Does anyone want to ask a question at this point, before I go on to the persecution?
Regarding briefly, liturgy, when I was college, I got the impression that Rollins John Bunyan thought that the use of a liturgy or the use of a prayer book was loanward and therefore wrong.
Mm-hmm.
John Owen said there's nothing wrong with prayer books or liturgy, provided they're not forced on a church.
Yeah.
Would that understanding be correct? Because I don't recall that I was wrong.
The question's about differences of opinion over in the Puritans about whether they should accept the liturgy or not. And Bunyan thought it was definitely going to Rome if you use the liturgy.
He thought that it was wrong. John Owen said liturgies or prayer books aren't wrong in themselves. Mm. The problem is that if you're trying to force them on people, then it's wrong.
Owen's view was more that you shouldn't impose them. Yes and no. So Owen thought you definitely shouldn't impose a liturgy on people. But he also said that it was to take away from the provision that Christ had made for the church to have a set liturgy. So he says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, the risen Christ has given to the church pastors and teachers. And so if he's given those to the church, he will equip them to do their job. So they don't need a previous generation or some other people somewhere else to provide them with prayers. Christ has gifted them to be the ones who preach and teach and pray in the churches. Now, you can use a set form of prayer if you want to. If you're the pastor, you think that's the most appropriate thing to do. But we shouldn't think that God has not gifted the current leadership of the church. He gives to his church pastors and teachers, and they have the gift of being able to pray and to lead. They don't need a liturgy. So that's an interesting view, which would be good to...
He wasn't too keen on the idea. He didn't say it's wrong, but he said, well...
That's right. He wasn't too keen on the idea. It's a good way of putting it.
Could do better.
Could do better. Yes, that's a rather devastating thing for John Owen to say to you. David.
I'm not sure I understand this, but I might be wrong. You may have talked to him. But Gerald, if I understand, is doing some research on the Lincolnshire church registers.
Ely, yes. Gerald Bray's doing some work on the Ely church registers, yeah.
If I understand you correctly, part of his aim is that some of these folk who left one day actually popped up fairly quickly in other parishes, obviously with a bit of blind eye going on. Are you aware of that?
Yes. Gerald Bray's work will be published soon, I think, to celebrate the 900th anniversary or something like that of the Diocese of Ely. He's looked at actual parish registers throughout this whole period to see what happened when people were chucked out in the days of Bloody Mary and at the Great Ejection, and what happened to those people afterwards. And yes, some of them did pop up again later, or their sons or grandsons popped as conforming clergy a little bit later, or they were just shifted sideways somewhere else. Of course, that's what you would expect. Many of them were silenced and just went off and you never hear of them again. But some of them do later conform. So there's a guy at St. Helens who is the third rector after 1662, Thomas Horton. He's a very reformed Presbyterian, was ejected in 1662, but later is able somehow, I don't know why actually, how he managed it, but he's able to conform and to be the rector of St. Helens after 1662. So sometimes it's with a nod and a wink from the bishop. Sometimes you were asked to sign a book to say you had subscribed your unfeigned consent and assent, and the bishop said, and if you have anything else you want to add. So if you wanted to say, yes, I subscribe and assent all of this, signed Tim Chapman, but I have a bit of a problem with the infant baptism stuff, or I'm not quite sure about this bit in the liturgy. If the bishop was happy with you writing that exception, fine. And of course, that's how that's how Presbyterianism works nowadays, isn't it? You have to have an examination before the presbytery, and you are to say whether you take any exceptions to bits in the Westminster Confession. So people usually take an exception over the Sabbath or something else like that. So yeah, some bishops allowed you to do that. Others did not.
But does that, what I've not understood is whether he's arguing whether that affects the overall figure of the total number of moves.
Yes, it will affect the overall figures of the number thrown out because some come back in. But I still think the overwhelming majority are thrown out and you don't see them again, or they're persecuted. Many of them die as well, of course, so in the intervening years. Yes.
I'm not good at history, but
where does the Pilgrim Fathers, the Pilgrim Fathers are at the beginning of the 17th century, I believe. So they go under Laud, really. When Archbishop Laud is having his way, lots of people leave for the Netherlands or they leave for America. After 1662, that doesn't happen in the same way. People choose to stay and suffer in Old England rather than become kings in New England. So, but they were offered places. So a few of them did leave, but not half as many, not even a tenth as many, I don't think, as left in the 1630s and that sort of period. Good question. Angus.
Could you say something about the views of episcopacy within the different groupings? Obviously, some were Anglican, but some were Presbyterian, sort of Scottish covenanters. And just what the sort of prevailing view amongst the different Puritans in that period.
What were the prevailing views of the Puritans on church government, episcopacy, Presbyterianism, that sort of thing? Good, yeah, that's a great question. I think, as I said, in the Elizabethan period, episcopacy was, just de rigueur, everyone was happy with that, reformed archbishops of Canterbury. There was a significant minority of Puritans, Thomas Cartwright, the guy who debates against Hooker, is a Presbyterian. And many of the kind of leading intellectuals are Presbyterians. So there's some pressure towards that. But really, people are happy with episcopacy when it's run by reformed evangelical guys. It's only with Lord and him coming in and trying to change things theologically that people become much more unhappy with episcopacy per se. And there's a great deal of pressure at the beginning of the 17th century from people saying, well, actually, we can see now that episcopacy doesn't really work because you get guys like this in. So Presbyterianism would be much better, wouldn't it? Checks and balances, that sort of thing. So there's much more pressure at the beginning of the 17th century. And many of the leading evangelicals and reformed guys at that point become much more forcefully Presbyterian, and there's more pressure then because they've seen episcopacy work badly with Laud. In the Westminster Assembly, well, before that, 1641 is a very key date for this. So Parliament comes back. There is a huge debate about abolishing bishops in 1641. That's one of my projects for my 10-year plan. I will write something on 1641 and what happened there. And really, the Presbyterians win the argument. So in the Westminster Assembly itself, in the 1640s, the huge majority are Presbyterian. There are one or two Episcopalians and a group of significant independents or Congregationalists who don't believe so much in the connectionalism between churches. And Presbyterianism is what the Directory of Public Worship and the Westminster Assembly puts out. And that really was a way of also uniting England with the Scottish Church, which was Presbyterian and had firmly rejected bishops as well. So really, at this period, if you are a Bible church and nation sort of reformed evangelical, you're probably a Presbyterian or have Presbyterian leanings in terms of your understanding of polity. It's only after 1662 that is squashed with the Great Persecution. It's interesting because I think nowadays that people do want to think about those issues again, don't they? Because we again see episcopacy not working brilliantly. Are you recording this? You're not working brilliantly when the episcopate is populated by people of liberal views. We think, well, do we actually want bishops or do we want to rethink that altogether? And it's worth having the debate and seeing that there are good reasons to have bishops. Wallace Benn's St. Antolin's lecture from a few years ago on James Usher, who came up with a plan to have a reduction of episcopacy. Yeah, more bishops with less power. So in Usher's plan, it's a way of compromising between Presbyterianism and episcopacy. So you'd have more bishops. So every rural dean would be a bishop, that sort of level, because he would then know all the ministers in the area and be able to have much more local oversight. But he wouldn't have as much power as the monarchical bishop of today does. That was a way of compromising the kind of Presbyterian parity of elders system with episcopacy. I think there was a lot in that. I'm sad that it wasn't really followed through and pushed. But the Presbyterians were in the ascendancy and they wanted Presbyterianism all out. It just didn't work in England. Never caught on. It's a great question. Let's plough on. Let's look at the Great Persecution and what happened to these guys before we go to lunch. Well, we'll have a bit of time for that. The Clarendon Code is the name given to the series of repressive bills passed to enforce a calculated and malicious persecution of those who did not conform. The Corporation Act of 1661 fenced off the establishment so that unless you took communion in the Church of England, you couldn't be elected to any public office. If you were elected to any public office, you were fined huge amounts of money unless you conformed to the Church of England. So actually some places did elect people they knew were nonconformists just so that they could say, oh, I can't be in this position, you'll have to fine me, just so they could get the money in from the fines. In 1664, an aborted plot in the north of England was used to justify passing an act against conventicles. Any religious meeting for prayer, preaching or Bible study, even in a field outside the auspices of the Church of England, was banned. So a family could have a Bible study and pray together along with their household servants, and they could be joined by four visitors who might be passing through. But if the number hearing a Bible reading and joining in prayer should exceed that, large fines could be imposed, even imprisonment. For a third offence of having a conventicle, you could even be transported beyond the seas for 7 years. Just imagine that. 7 years in America. A fate worse than death. Some dissenters, of course, under that sort of pressure, gave up meeting illegally and contented themselves with attendance at the parish church. Others attended both the parish church and their own conventicle, employing various tactics to avoid being caught. Some of them met at 2 o'clock in the morning. The Congregational Church in Stepney, near where I live, had a concealed room in the ceiling of a meeting house where they met. I like this one the best. The dissenters at Olney met at Three Counties Point, the place where Bucks and Bedfordshire and Northants all converge, so that if they saw the police from one county coming to get them, they just hop over the border so they can't get them anymore. The Broadmead Baptists in Bristol were constantly harassed by their mayor, and after losing several pastors to prison for preaching at conventicles and not wanting to close their meetings to outsiders and lose that great opportunity for the gospel, they hung up a great big curtain in the meeting place so that, in front of the preacher. So you probably like that idea if the preacher's ugly, but so that if any informers came into the meeting, they could hear the gospel, but they wouldn't see who was preaching it, and so they couldn't get into trouble. More ingeniously, we're told, Brother Gifford's people took this course. A company of tall brethren stand around him that speaks, and having his feet near his feet made a trapdoor in the floor, when any informers come in, they let down the brother that speaks into the room below. So if Paul and James could just come to the front and hold up something, and we'll dig a hole here. Now, exciting, rather terrifying life in these sorts of churches, and naturally not everyone was happy to endure that kind of persecution. The Broadmeads reports of 1665 say that six of their members were excommunicated from the church for neglecting their duty of meeting together because they were afraid. Do not give up meeting together, or we'll excommunicate you. Such fear, of course, seemed a bit reasonable when the penal code was often enforced with quite unnecessary malice. In 1665, there's a great example of this, when many clergy understandably left the city of London as the plague struck in 1665. Many nonconformist ministers remained behind, though, and stepped into the vacated pulpits to give spiritual solace to the dying, the bereaved, and the frightened people of London. One of those brave souls was Samuel Annesley, the grandfather of John and Charles Wesley, who was ejected in 1662, but had a conventicle just off Bishopsgate, where we park our cars these days. For a service on a Sunday morning. Men like Annesley and Thomas Watson and John Owen came out of hiding, really. They kept a low profile. They came out of hiding at this point to preach to people in their hour of need during the plague. Parliament, however, sitting at a safe distance in Oxford, was outraged at their impudence. So they passed what's known as the 5 Mile Act, a notorious act banishing all dissenting ministers from an area of 5 miles around any town in which they've preached or been a minister or visited as a minister. Now, that made life very difficult, especially for those who preached in several churches in a neighbourhood. You're not allowed within 5 miles of that place anymore. Arthur Barham, the ejected minister of St Helens, felt compelled. He had to leave his wife and his children in Hackney and moved to his family home in Sussex at this point. And things get even worse for him a little bit later. Enforcement of the penal laws against the dissenters was never as rigid as it might have been. It varied from place to place, depending on the attitude of the local officials. Even so, as John Coffey puts it, Anglican persecutors could now appeal to a formidable legal arsenal, which potentially made possible a Puritan Holocaust. Now, although the worst possibilities of that were never realised, the Restoration period did witness a persecution of Protestants by Protestants without parallel in 17th century Europe. I'm going to skip a little bit of what I said because I've answered too many questions and there's not enough time for some of this, but you can find most of it in the book. At this stage, as I said before, St Helens Bishopsgate is in the possession of Reformed theologian Thomas Horton, who'd been injected in 1660, but later conformed. He was a noted tutor to young Presbyterian scholars at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. And according to one contemporary manuscript, Dr. Horton hath a very great congregation of half-conformists, in whom he hath much interest. He was a man of very good learning and a constant laborious preacher. Good man. Interesting to note that St. Helens today might also be characterised by some as a large congregation of half-conformists. Now, we should be in no doubt about how explicitly persecution was demanded by the authorities. Scarcely a tremor of embarrassment disturbed the voices of Arminian preachers who called for a holy violence, a rigorous and seasonable execution of the penal laws against the fanatic vermin whose conventicles trouble the land. Things got much worse in the 1680s, and Arthur Barham was eventually sort of harried and fined and eventually died, a broken man. Let's skip to Tolerance and the Glorious Revolution before I conclude with some reflections for today. Of course, when James II came to the throne in 1685, he was the first openly Roman Catholic monarch to do so since Bloody Mary. And although he pushed his own religion as far and as fast as he was able to, he also conceived of a plan to extend toleration to dissenters, but of course only as a way of uniting them against Anglicans. It was not long before he was forced to flee the country, having alienated almost everybody. The Act of Toleration, which was signed by his daughter, Queen Mary, and her Protestant husband, William of Orange, in 1689, put an official end to persecution. Yes, you can cheer if you want, brother. Our Northern Irish brethren are probably cheering at that point too. At this point, after several failed experiments in religious suppression, the English people were ready to admit a certain degree of pluralism within a Trinitarian and Protestant umbrella, and to reject the exclusivist claims of Arminian and High Church Anglicans. Although it would be more than a century before the Protestant nonconformists would gain proper civil equality, the years of persecuting them were now over. If you'll allow me 10 minutes before we go to lunch for a few reflections for today. Is that all right? You got enough time on the tape? I got 8 minutes. Okay, we'll go. The period of English history then, from the Restoration to the Act of Toleration in 1689, is a formative one for us. Conformity and non-conformity, rather than being parties vying for influence within the same established church, became separate institutions, which we know today as the Church of England and the Free Churches. And the debates and the debacles of these years taught the English Church the important fundamental truth that in matters of religion, God alone is Lord of the conscience, and it ought not to be compelled by the doctrines and commandments of men. As Martin Luther had discovered at the start of the Reformation, it is neither right nor safe to go against conscience, and it was now also clear that coercing somebody else's conscience is a dangerous game. And yet some disciplinary and doctrinal boundaries always do need to be drawn in a church. Toleration cannot lightly be granted to those who would undermine the basis of tolerance itself. Despite what some people would like us to believe, the Church of England has never been infinitely elastic in its doctrinal inclusiveness. It is not a melting pot for an unlimited variety of Christian traditions. Certainly wasn't that in 1662. Perhaps if Anglicanism in this period is to be seen as a via media, it should be seen as a meeting of varieties of Reformed Christianity with a High Church Arminianism on the other side. Though the way I've recounted the story should make it clear which of those two groups has a better claim to be originally authentically Anglican, and which needed to crowbar its way into the tradition using ejection and persecution on a nationwide scale. But that may be somewhat controversial, especially if you start to see the Laudians of the 17th century as equivalent to our liberals. Martin Lloyd-Jones, said that 1662 was the year that the hope of the Puritans was finally dashed to the ground, their final defeat and the exploding of all their longings. Now, I got into trouble with one member of my congregation for disagreeing with the doctor here. But he's wrong, isn't he? He's wrong. He had an agenda. Perhaps he wanted people to feel that since Puritanism had failed in the Church of England, they may as well give up on it. But we should not be defeatist about this. Yes, it was bad for a generation, but Reformed theology did not die out, and it was back with a vengeance in the 18th century, as we'll see this afternoon. And I think it remains alive today, doesn't it? Looking round, Reformed Puritan hopes for the church are very much alive. We mustn't be hopeless about the past. Do we have anything to learn from those who were rejected? Well, I think it would be a tragedy if another issue of conscience was to force many of us out in a manner reminiscent of 1662. Such as, for instance, an attempt to compel all ministers to accept the authority of women bishops. That could be a similar sort of issue for many of us. But I should point out as well, the established church is not the same as it was in the 17th century. We've incorporated much of what Usher put into his synodical system of government. Although we lack bishops with the same reformed theology and understanding of episcopacy as Usher to run it for some reason. Why don't we have bishops like that? Happily, of course, the Church of England no longer insists on unfeigned consent and assent to absolutely everything in its liturgy and articles. Today, of course, the prayer book is only one of a bewildering array of liturgical options. There's too much flexibility, I would say. But variations often go unchallenged. The old debates over church government and ceremonial don't divide us as they once did. Today it's the doctrine of creation, with its entailments in the areas of sexual morality, the sacredness of life, the sanctity of marriage, relationships between the genders, which is the front line of our disputes. Those who dissent from the prevailing orthodoxy of the powerful few at the heart of government on those issues may find themselves in a position not dissimilar to the reformed Puritans of the Restoration era. Now, that should not be a reason for us to despair, though. It's an urgent call for us to reform the Church of England. It has an honoured history in the evangelisation and edification of our nation, and we must strengthen it against these destructive tides. Is it the best boat to fish from? I don't know. But it would be foolish to abandon a leaky but serviceable vessel. And it would be criminally negligent to just throw ourselves overboard merely for lack of proper attention to what's going on. Whether the great ejection and the greater persecution were a tragedy for the gospel, as many thought at the time, I'm not so sure. Thomas Hardcastle was the often imprisoned pastor of the Broadmead Baptists, and he said this to his flock: "It has been our great error that we have not trusted in the power of God. We have reasoned about the worst that men can do, but we have not believed the best that God can do. We are sowing for posterity. The generation coming on will have the good fruit of this present persecution." Well, there's a lot for us to reflect on in the example of faith in these men and women of a former heroic age. For them, doctrine mattered, and the truth was worth fighting and dying and suffering and being kicked out for. If such a thing was to happen again, I hope and pray that we would rise to the challenge of discipleship which they set for us. Why don't I pray, and then we can go for lunch.